Heavenly Father, in you we live and move and have our being. We pray that you guide and govern us through your Holy Spirit, that in all the cares and occupations of our lives, we won't forget you, but remember that we're ever walking in your sight. Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen. Pardon me, I've got a little bit of a cold. It's more than my thick rural Texas accent. quick show of hands. How many of you have been to this meeting before? All newbies. Fantastic. I think you'll enjoy it. How many of you have been on a short or long-term mission trip abroad before? Several. Okay. How many of you plan to or would like to? I think that's inherent. I guess I shouldn't have asked that question. I think there's a little bit for everybody in this. Whether you've been before, it may just kind of reinforce some things. I think it'll be especially helpful if you've never been before. On your table, there's a resource packet, kind of old school. I was born in the Eisenhower administration, so paper still, I like it. We'll talk about those at the end. The most important one, you can kind of read some of the other stuff and throw them away. The last page, however, has a lot of resources that you can connect with. If you don't, you know, if you're not sure where you want to go, you can contact these people. This is their website as well as the contact person. These are all, I think the bulk of these are Texas-based, okay? Full disclosure, a little bit about me. I am not a full-time missionary. Okay? I have never been on a long-term mission, 2 years, 3 years. I'm a habitual short-term missionary, repetitive, all in the same country, and we'll talk about that just for a second. I'm currently on the board, as she said, of directors for a group called The Cries of a Child. I'm also their clinical consultant. They've been on the ground in Burundi for 10 years. Their founders are Samantha and Isaiah Torres, amazing people. They've been there the entire time. Sam is fluent in the language. Started as really kind of church planning, sharing the gospel. There's a history in this country we'll talk a little bit about. There's a lot of orphans, and so they started an orphanage. It's not like you think, kind of the big warehouse orphanage. It's a group of family homes, 6 children to 7 children per home with a house mother, all of whom are widowed. A trade school, a Bible college, and then about 3 years ago, we hooked up together. The reason I booked 4 years ago is we opened the Cornerstone Clinic. It's in an incredibly medically underserved area in Burundi. We've opened 22 months ago and have seen about 27,000 people. So I'll let you do the math on that. This is Dr. Viator. He's our medical director there and the staff physician, amazing Christian guy. So things are going very well. So what we're going to do here, with that just as background, we're going to use Burundi as an example of culture, okay? Because we're going to start this off with what are your challenges if you go to volunteer, and what are your challenges if you're trying to start a program of anything, okay? We're medical, so we're talking about clinic development, but an agriculture project, church planting, whatever. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Burundi. Burundi is in East Central Africa. It's about the size of Maryland. It's landlocked. To the west is Lake Tanganyika and the very messy eastern portion of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. To the east is Tanzania and the south. And to the north is a neighbor that they have a lot in common with historically and ethnically, and that's Rwanda. It's made up of the Bantu people. The Bantu have 3 tribes. The Hutu, which make up about 85% of the population there. The Tutsi, which make up about 15% of the population there, although that's probably high now. It's probably closer to 10 or 12%. And the Twa, or Batwa, which are pejoratively called pygmies, and they make up about 3% of the population. The average male in Burundi lives to about 48. The average woman, about 52. And those are a little old statistics. Those are World Health Organization 2013. If you're a Twa, or a Batwa, you live to be about 27, okay? It's a male-dominated society. There is gender violence. I wouldn't say with impunity. It's getting better, but the authorities oftentimes don't do much if a husband beats his wife. Like the bulk of Africa, it's got a colonial background. Initially, Germany in the late 1800s. And during World War II, the Belgians colonized it. Since independence in 1962, it's been plagued with a lot of civil wars, and you can insert the word genocide twice, 72, and the most recent of which, most extreme, was 1993. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Hotel Rwanda. If you haven't, I encourage it. It won an Academy Award, I think, in 2006, something like that. It's somewhat fictionalized, but it talks about what went on. the same day, a plane was shot down in Kigali with the president of both countries, and that unleashed a genocide. That's a whole other topic. But in Rwanda, 800,000 people were killed in 100 days, mostly by primitive tools, machetes and clubs. The Burundians speak in allegory, and they'll tell you that Rwanda sneezed and Burundi caught the cold, because the genocide lasted in Burundi almost a decade, up to 2006, really 13 years. The numbers are a little bit elusive. If you look on Wikipedia, it'll say 280,000 people. I know people with the UN and in aid groups there, excuse me, they say it's probably closer to 600,000 people. But that's left the infrastructure kind of wrecked. The language in Burundi is Kirundi. It's a language spoken by about 14 million people in the world. French is the official language. You won't find English there except aid groups. It's an agrarian society. It's a very mountainous society. It's beautiful. It looks like Hawaii, but it's very deforested. 85% of the population outside of the capital of Bujumbura are subsistence farmers. Of those, 90% farm without a plow or a tractor. Okay. Education issues. The government's pretty broke right now. Primary school is provided up through sixth grade. After that, you have to take a test, and there's a fee. A lot of parents want their kids to stay home anyway because they can help farm and go fetch water. It's currently the poorest country in the world. They kind of go back and forth with South Sudan, Malawi. 80% of the population lives below the international poverty level of $1.25 American, and the average Burundian lives on less than $300 a year. One in five children die before age five. These are Twa, or Batwa, pygmy. The maternal mortality rate is the fifth highest in the world. There's a physician in Burundi for every 35,000 people. There's a physician in Harris County for every 385. This number's a little bit old, okay? So with that in mind, what are our, just throw out terms. This is low stress audience participation, I promise. What are your barriers? You're going to go there. So listen, Burundi is an extreme. I get it. But there's places equally messy, right? Syria right now, South Sudan, parts of Iraq. You heard some of that last night, and you'll hear Dr. Paul talk about it. So what barriers do you have to do anything there? Language, yeah. Anything else? Pardon? Resources, yeah. I literally jotted these down in 5 minutes. These are very broad. But one is historical, colonialism and genocide. There's a lot of issues with that, to think about it. And if you're over about 20-something years old and you try and set up a group there or a clinic, they may look at you and go, where were you in 93? You know? Legitimate question. Language. You're right. How many of you are fluent in Kirundi? How many can speak French without a translator? Okay. So you're going to need a translator, right? You're going to need people to help you talk. Corruption. This isn't a Burundian problem. There's corruption in the developed world. There's a lot of corruption in the undeveloped world. As a Christian, what do you think about paying a bribe to get permission to do fill in the blank, to buy some land? Something to think about, right? Infrastructure, like we said, it's really an issue. Tribalism. It's not, believe it or not, it's not as much of a problem because right now there's a party that has both tribes, and if you're not a party member, then you're kind of out. But still, that's a lot of memory, isn't it? Okay? So these people are sitting in your waiting room, and they're also working for you. Okay? So that's a consideration. Education issues. We just talked about this. I mean, you know, there's a great... treating your patients. Think about that. Most of us are medical. Think about that in the States. The undereducated, sometimes, I mean, it's tough, right, to get compliance. What about there? What about your employees? What about the people working in your clinic? Are they educated enough to do their job? Transportation. I don't know if any of you know, in the global health literature, there's this concept called the last mile, okay, because that's where we really need to get our resources. You know, you can fly into any developing world capital, and you can get probably some stuff done. But then concrete turns to dirt that turns to a path. And sometimes that's where you really need your resources to go. Can you get it there? Transportation. And then extreme poverty and malnutrition. There's a great book, and I didn't put this on here, but if you ever get a chance to read it, it's called A Thousand Hills to Heaven. It's by a guy named Paul Ruxton. He's a Jewish guy that lives in Rwanda, and someday this guy may win the Nobel Prize for clinic development, but he has like Ruxton's Rule of Six or something like that. But number one is hungry people can't think, feed them. You've got to do that before you, I mean, you can't really get things going until you take care of that. Okay, so with this in mind, we're going to jump into this. And you can see what we're talking about are cultural barriers, right? The word missionary, and I don't want to get into this too deep. I've got a small problem with it in the sense that if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you're on a mission, but where, wow, all that. So let's label this a cross-cultural trip, short term for this one, okay? And we're going to explore a number of items dealing with culture that will affect you. One is culture shock. One is reverse culture shock. The third is ethnocentrism, language, issues with time. We're going to spend a little time on that. And then social etiquette and sort of cultural ideas about service or receiving aid, if you will. Okay. I promise this isn't going to turn into a Sociology 101 conference. I promise. This is going to be two slides like this. But we have to start by understanding what is really culture. And there's a lot of definitions. This is from a guy named Paul Quast, K-W-A-S-T. And he calls it the man from Mars approach. It's the outside looking into a culture. He says there's four layers. The first is behaviors. That's customs, language, products. It sort of answers the question, what is done? Then values, a lot of behaviors dictated by values. And it answers the question within a society, what's good, what's best? Then there's beliefs, what is true? But really at the heart of any culture is worldview. And that answers questions like, what is real? Who are we? What's happening? Or maybe other things like, what do we feel about visions or dreams or angels? Who carries the full burden or weight of honor and shame in a society? Is it a woman? Is it a man? Is it even an individual? Is it a family? Is it a tribe? Is it a community? Amazing guy named Paul Hebert. I won't spend much time on this. He is really the missionary's missionary. He was born to missionary parents in India, spent his entire life on mission or teaching missions. He's a PhD cultural anthropologist, probably the most foremost Christian cultural anthropologist around. And he says, when we enter a new culture, we become keenly aware of the fact that other people live differently. At first, we see the differences in dress, food, language, behavior. Then we learn there's profound differences in beliefs, feelings, and values. Finally, we begin to realize there are fundamental differences in worldview. People in different cultures don't live in the same world with different labels, but in radically different worlds. So let's look at just, this is the last slide like this. What is our worldview, what is the developing world, but especially America, okay, compared to the bulk of the developing world? Well, we're very egocentric, right? It's more about the individual, especially as Americans. Man, we are all about individual rights and independence. What's more important to them is belonging, family, family harmony, family security. I think you'd agree that for the most part, status is earned in our society, for the most part. Obviously, there's nepotism, and we all understand that. But look, I'm a public school kid that's two generations away from overalls, and I'm a doctor. Right? And so we can accomplish things here. In a lot of the developing world, that's very difficult. It's inherited, okay? Okay, so let's jump into this. First topic, as I said, is culture shock. Now, I've been on both ends of this, and let me kind of explain for a second. 13 months ago, my wife and I brought two persecuted refugees from East Central Africa. She was 7 months pregnant with malaria when she came. So here we are, 14 months later, they have jobs, they're adapting, but my word, it's been a rocky road. Okay? They'd never seen a microwave, air conditioning, heating, a stove. Here they are. Look at our pace as opposed to those, and we'll talk about this a little bit more. But you can even have some component of culture shock within a culture. Now, think about this. Let's say we took a rancher from rural West Texas and we teleported him into Queens or inner city San Francisco. right? There's going to be some angst, right? Now, the language is kind of the same. The values are kind of the same. Or the other way, what if someone had grown up in Manhattan and they went to prep school and then Columbia and they're a Wall Street banker and they kind of fly everywhere and you throw them into Wyoming? But this pales in comparison to the cultural chasm between our culture and the developing world and the emotional roller coaster that kind of goes with it. There's components to it. What is culture shock? Webster's defines it as a sense of confusion and uncertainty, sometimes with feelings of anxiety that may affect people exposed to an alien culture environment without adequate preparation. Now, we'll talk about preparation a little bit, but preparation doesn't make you culturally competent. There's layers of it. I'm going to use kind of a short model. Really, the first thing when you get to a place is kind of a honeymoon phenomena. You're so excited to be there. But very quickly, kind of reality takes in and you're exposed to suffocating poverty. Some of the things we talked about, corruption, things you're not used to, right? And you become sad. It can lead to overwhelming sadness. And one of the things that happens is this sort of comparative analysis of where you are on the planet compared to them. Quiz Bono's quote is something about a quirk of longitude and latitude may dictate if you starve to death or not. There's something to that. And that leads to some guilt, maybe displaced guilt, I don't know. But it can make you feel guilty for your lot in life as opposed to them. Now, the next one's the Mzungu factor. Now, Mzungu is a Swahili word that literally translates to white person, but I've noticed in the last few years, that's kind of morphed into just Westerner, yeah, foreigner, okay? And with that comes some baggage you may not think about. Now, you are going to be looked at appropriately to the person who comes to help fill in the blank, you know, farming, church planting, but in our case, clinic work, you know, medicine, okay? But there's something more to that because you're an American, and because of that, you've got money and superiority. And money, and education, and money, okay? I have been to Burundi multiple times. The last, but because of this, you may be looked at as their answer out of poverty, not just what you're there to do. The last trip to Burundi I went to, which is 8 months ago, is the only time I've not been directly approached by someone wanting me to get them, and sometimes their family, to the United States. You're gonna be quoted higher prices at markets, okay? The most expensive bananas I've ever bought, relatively. I was at this market in Gitega, and my French is kind of get the ball over the net. It's not very good, and it's got this thick Texas accent. And so I know 30 Kirundi words, and I thought I got this great deal. I go back to the clinic, and the locals ask how much I paid, and they laugh. They go, you got Mzungud, okay? And then little things like, you know, they want to carry your bags or take your picture, and you don't know that they want money for that. And you can start feeling taken advantage of, but you've got to realize they're trying to survive, right? That's the second thing. The third one is futility. After you're there a while, you'll begin sometimes to retreat, both emotionally and physically, okay? Instead of embedding yourself in the culture, eating with them, trying to learn their language, trying to bond with them, because that's what they're about. Remember? Family security, long-term relationships. You start saying, I want some Western food. I want to hear people speak English. I want to see if the Rockets won or something like that, you know. And so all these things can be kind of overwhelming to you. Here's some tips. First of all, in this day and age, prepare up front. I mean, we've all got a smartphone or a tablet. There's no reason, even if you're not connected to a group as you're planning, that you can't learn about a culture. Again, doesn't make you culturally competent. Probably the most important thing in here, you wouldn't be at this meeting if you didn't believe in the power of prayer. Okay, there is a peace, obviously. Prepare up front with prayer. Pray while you're there. Judge people, one person, don't judge the whole culture. Okay, think about this. Let's say we're all going to go out to lunch together, and we walk across the street, and some guy cuts us off in traffic and curses at us and gives us a middle finger. We're not going to judge all Houstonians or Texans or Americans by this guy. The bulk of people are glad you're there. They're welcoming you, and they really appreciate it. But there's bad actors everywhere, and you may come in touch with them. Maintain flexibility, humor, and embrace your cultural differences. This is me. It's not every day you can be on a nice carbon frame bike running through Burundi and get passed by a guy with 100... you're experiencing is temporary, and it's expected. One of my favorite Psalms, weeping may endure for the night, but joy comes in the morning. We're going to switch and talk about reverse culture shock right quick. I don't have a specific slide for it, but reverse culture shock is the way you feel when you come back, especially toward your home culture, your home environment. I never was really plagued with culture shock badly, some of it. I'm 58. I started this in my 40s. Okay, so I was a little more worldly, a little more mature, but I still, to this day, have significant issues with reverse culture shock. I hate buffet lines. You know, 32 to 36% of the world's food is not eaten. And when you've seen people starve, that bugs you. I don't like seeing people waste water. And I can be really self-righteous and sanctimonious. My wife had to have a talk with me because if you said, I'm starving, I corrected you. No, you're hungry. Starving and hungry are very different. Or I took over a shift from one of my fellow docs, and he said, okay, I had this horrible night. You know, I was so busy. And I went, wow, you got paid for it. There's electricity and water. And what's this internet thing you're talking about? You know? So you've got to be kind of careful with it. There's a guy named David Jacket. Is David here? He said he might try and come. Now, David is head of the Perspectives course. And look into that sometime too. I didn't put that on your resource page. It's sort of a mission of global outreach, spreading the gospel course. But he's the Texas director. And he told this story of the first time he went on mission. And I think he went to Guatemala. I may be making that up. But he's in high school or college 30, 20 years ago. And he comes back, and he lives in the Dallas area. So his mom picks him up at DFW, and he's just on fire for you know, just passionate about this. And his mom picks him up, and the first thing she says is, David, I'm sorry I'm a little late, but you can't imagine the traffic. They've changed the roads, and it took me 25 minutes to get here. He just became deflated because he's thinking, 36 hours ago, we buried an orphan. If we'd had a car, maybe we could have got him somewhere. He said it took a lot of grace. Right? So this is very, very real. One of the assets or one of the resources in the back is a group called Team, I think, and they have a kind of a cool journal, and they help you debrief from... reverse culture shock. Okay, topic number three, ethnocentrism. That's the belief in inherent superiority of one's ethnic group or culture. So in other words, the way we do things is normal. The way they do things is peculiar or odd. So you take that down another step. The way we do things is right. The way they do things is wrong. Take it another step. The way we do things is superior and they're inferior, and we're going to go fix your problem for you. We've got this. Okay? That can lead not only to a great deal of lack of respect, but also, just on a practical level, it can sabotage anything you're trying to accomplish. Okay? How does this sort of play out with the boots on the ground kind of thing? Well, let's think about disease or medical problems here. I think we kind of understand it as this... kind of amalgamation of genetics and lifestyle and so on and so forth. So for instance, if you're a woman in this room, you've got a 1 in 10 chance of developing breast cancer in your life, right? If you've got a first degree relative, as a mom or sister, it's 1 in 6. If you're a man, your prostate cancer numbers are pretty close to that. So there's a genetic. If you're diabetic and your hemoglobin A1C is greater than 7, then your slope takes off for all the ravages of diabetes, nephropathy, neuropathy, accelerated atherosclerosis, et cetera. If you've had an MI or if you've had any kind of a vascular event, we know secondary prevention, if you take aspirin, your risk falls 44%. That's a little bit conflicting now. But anyway, we know those. And there's also lifestyle issues. If you smoke, you're at higher risk for accelerated atherosclerosis, emphysema. If you drink to excess, so you get it. Okay? If you're in the developing world, you may be sick because of some thought you had about somebody or because your grandfather cheated somebody on some land or some manifestation of some ancestral spirit that's coming to plague you because of your relatives or someone, a local folk healer or witch doctor, put a curse on you. And you can't minimize that. That's true in the bulk of the developing world. So again, how this plays out on the ground, I've got a great example. And I don't remember. I think it was in Mali. It may have been in Ghana. But anyway, there's a Western group that was setting up a TB eradication program, and it was set up beautifully. They got local health volunteers, you know, bicultural, to go out, identify the people, tested them, got them on medication. 6 months later, results weren't that good. So they suspected noncompliance, but they didn't know why. So the local health care workers go out, kind of interview people, and as it turns out, some of the folk healers and witch doctors told them, don't take that, take these herbs and boil it and drink the tea, and it'll work. What a great opportunity to be ethnocentric. Look, I practice in a town with a 24% poverty level, a lot of undereducated people. And on my busy days, I never say it, but God forgive me, I think it, just take these pills. Trust me, I know more than you do, just take it. That's extreme, I don't really mean that, but you, we've all been there kind of frustrated that I can help you if you'll just do this. And this is a great example of how that could have been done. But what did they do? They got the community health volunteers. They met with the folk healers, examined the sort of broth or tea. And obviously it wasn't going to cure TB, but it helped cough, interestingly enough. So they get together and said, we feel like if we use your medicine and our medicine together, we can make a big difference. Well, what happened? TB was eradicated. So again, you have to be very, very careful because this can lead, as I said, not only a lack of respect, you can sabotage your goal, and also it's pretty paternalistic. Okay. Concepts of time. This is perfect because I'm trying to suppress my inherent inclination to talk too much, and we're going to get late. Time. One of the first things you'll notice when traveling to the developing world is time is treated very differently. Okay. And in fact, the Peace Corps back in the 70s, I believe, came up with two definitions. The first is monochronic time. And that's that time is the given and people are the variable. The needs of the people are adjusted to suit the demands of time, such as schedules, deadlines, etc. Time is quantifiable and a limited amount of it is available. People can do one thing at a time and finish it before doing something else. Okay, we are living monochronic time, right? You knew this lecture started at a certain time. And I know I've got 55 minutes to do this, or otherwise, somebody's going to hold up 10 minutes, 5 minutes, because we've got to finish because you've got 10 minutes to get to the next lecture. And then tomorrow morning, you've got to set your alarm for 5:30 or 6:30 or 7 or whatever, so you can work out or read or pray and then go to work or school, right? It's monochronic time. That's what we do. And we think it works pretty well for us. Then there's polychronic time. That is that time is the servant and tool of the people. It's adjusted to suit the needs of the people. More time is always available. You're never too busy. And it's not necessary to finish your business with one person before starting another. Okay, so here's how this can play out. Let's say I live in a village that's about a two-hour walk from George. George owns some land, and we're going to work out a deal where I'm going to try and plant some cassava, and we're going to share the profits, and it's going to be mutually. So 2 hours, okay? Two-hour walk. We're going to meet at 1. So that morning, I get up, I do some things, I get kind of behind, I start walking at 11:30, and then I run into Jean-Pierre, who owns a fruit market. And he said, listen, I noticed your wife's basket is broken. She couldn't carry it. And I said, yeah, she mentioned that to me. He says, well, my next-door neighbor makes baskets. Oh, fantastic. So I go with Jean-Pierre, we sit, we have some tea, discuss the terrible political situation, whatever's going on in the community, have another glass of tea. He introduces me to the neighbor. So we barter a little bit, we have another glass of tea. I say, oh, that's too much. I start to walk away, calls me back. We come out with a deal. Okay, now it's noon, okay, 12:15. So I start walking, and I get up to the village, and I meet George, and I come down to the little plot of land, and he's on the porch talking to a man in a suit, and it takes him about 20 minutes. So we get down here. So now we're an hour and a half late. That's okay with everybody. Nobody gets bruised with that. Now, as a Westerner, we are fill in the blank, check boxes, be on time kind of thing. It can drive you a little nuts. What they're dealing with is relationships, though, right? And what we're dealing with is this has to get done, or I just can't get anything else going. So while that's happening, there's also the whole process of slow pace and waiting. Now, these all kind of play together, and I'll bring this kind of full circle. In our clinic, we start seeing people at 8 o'clock. At 7:30, there's a Bible study and a testimonial, and when that's finished, we sing some hymns, and when that's finished, there's a very short sort of community health lecture, if you will, preventive medicine, you know, boil your water, wearing shoes, those kind of things. And we get started, and by the time 8 o'clock rolls around, there may be 50 people waiting to be seen. We see somewhere between 50 and 80 most days. And guess what? They're not playing words with friends. They're not doing Snapchats and sending it to their friends. Okay, they're not on Instagram. They're waiting. Okay, so now you're, while they're waiting there, you're the volunteer. You're on your short-term mission, and you're told to go down 3 blocks to the minister of fill in the blank because you've got to pick up this certificate so we can start something else. Okay? So you go, and being a good American, you're supposed to be there at 1. Being a good American, you show up at 10:50. There's a room full of people. You go to the secretary. She said, the minister's very busy, but we'll be with you. We'll get that taken care of. And again, now you don't have a smartphone or there's no internet, so you can't play words with friends and take Snapchat and whatever. So you start getting nervous and tachycardic, and you know, because you're an American. You don't like to wait. We don't wait very well. And I'm not going to get into the generational thing of some of you younger ones, but anyway. So this goes on and on and on. About 30 minutes later, the secretary says, the minister's very busy and you'll have to reschedule. Well, the minister's the guy in the suit talking to George. Okay? Now, in our society, making people wait can seem very rude. Okay? But you're going to experience it. And just realize it's a very relaxed way of dealing with time and punctuality. So don't be insulted by it. It's going to happen. But also go back a couple of slides. They are about, it's not laziness. They are about relationships, and we're about task-oriented getting things done. This is a great quote. I found this the other day. This is a Peace Corps volunteer. He says, when I first traveled out to my island via the cargo ship, I was told to report at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, late on the day on Thursday. Welcome to a tiny island in the South Pacific. All right, we're going to switch to language really quickly, how to deal with translators and how to deal with locals. I came up with the bulk of this slide because of this amazing young man. This is Igor Agiraniza. We took this picture in Kigali 2 years ago, but we met many years before that. He was a first-year college student at the University of Burundi. He's now a fourth-year medical student in the University of Rwanda. And I learned almost everything about dealing with translators and locals because of Igor. Igor is fluent in Swahili, Kirundi, and his French is pristine. He learned to speak English and some German by watching YouTube videos. Beautiful mind. Amazing kid. Okay. Things I learned. Speak more slowly than usual and use simple language. And also avoid colloquialisms. If I came in here earlier and I go, morning, how y'all doing? You don't have to be a Texan. You think, oh, that's pretty sloppy. But you know I said, I dropped the G on morning. Good morning, how you doing? I meant good morning. How are all of you doing? Igor doesn't hear that, okay? So avoid colloquialisms and try and speak the Queen's English as much as you can. Do 2 or 3 sentences at a time and then pause and allow the interpreter to translate. Avoid long conversations with the interpreter. I think this is really important, okay? And again, what would happen is I tried to maintain eye contact with my local, with my patient. But Igor and I would start talking and we'd kind of get distracted. And one point, he kind of giggled and said, I don't know how to say pleurisy. What did she think? She thinks we're laughing at her, right? So maintain your role as the interpreter there, okay? This is actually kind of segues into this. After several sessions, your interpreter may notice a pattern to your questions and ask what they think your next question would be. First time I was there, there was this rash of waterborne illnesses. I mean, there was a lot of poverty in this area, and people were getting their water from the streams. They couldn't afford wood to boil the water. So we were just treating a lot of this. And so the question line would kind of go, what brings you here today? Well, I'm having abdominal pain and cramps and diarrhea. How long have you had it? X amount of time. Where do you get your water? From a stream. Blah, blah, blah. So by about the third patient, I would say, what brings you here today? They would speak Kirundi, and Igor would look at me and they go, they need those blue pills. Okay, so you've got to be kind of careful with that because you're the medical professional. Okay, so you've got to make sure things don't get lost because of that. And then obviously treat your interpreter with respect. Interacting with locals, introduce yourself and your interpreter. Speak directly to the person as if you were speaking English. Again, keep looking at them. Don't talk to the interpreter. It comes across as being very rude, even though you don't mean it to do. Pay attention to nonverbal cues. We don't have to speak a foreign language to realize when someone is hurting, emotionally or physically, right? What's their eye contact? What's their body language? Are they holding something? I think that's very important too. This is probably the most important thing. Try and learn some basic phrases and greetings. If you can say good morning, good evening, hello, goodbye, God bless you, it'll take you a long way. And then lastly, regularly repeat back what the patient's telling you. I just got the 10-minute sign. See, I'm falling behind. Sorry. Social etiquette. Just look this up. I'm going to give you some examples really quick. No matter where you go, look these things up because they vary from culture to culture. Standard of dress, I would just caution you, dress conservatively. If you're a man, tuck your shirt in, wear a collared shirt if you can, wear long pants and closed-toed shoe. If you're a woman, cover your shoulders, cover your ankles. Now, that's going to vary from place to place. I can tell you, in Burundi, even if you're a Burundian, if you're a upper-class, elite Burundian and you wear shorts, that's looked at as you think you don't take yourself seriously, you're immature, okay? So there's things to think about. Greetings, okay? In America, especially in the business world, shaking hands aggressively and maintaining eye contact is looked at favorably, right? In a lot of the world, that's looked at as aggression. Eating customs. As a visitor, you're going to possibly be treated as a special guest and expected to eat some things that you're not sure what they are, you know? I know in certain parts of the world, if you clean your plate, they're gonna fill it back up. Other places, they may expect you to clean your plate. I know the two times back in Burundi, I'm kind of a closet vegetarian. I mean, if you cook me a steak, I'm gonna eat it. But we were out visiting this area, my wife and I, it was the first time she had come, and a friend of ours was taking us around, and there was this kind of creepy looking meat. And I made an A in anatomy, and I'm not sure exactly what it was. And it turned out it was chicken. And so I'm kind of playing around it and eating vegetables and mangoes and stuff. And Freddie Tuyazeri leans across and says, you know, chicken's very expensive here and you're an honored guest. So from another culture, and they kind of push you out of the way and start taking a picture of this kid. What are you going to do? If you're in a bad mood, you may knock the camera out of their hand, but if nothing else, you're going to call Child Protective Services or the police or grab. Why would it be okay for us to do that? Okay, so don't take pictures of kids without getting permission. And then lastly, gestures. Be very careful. Has anybody ever been to rural Turkey anywhere? Have you? Is the okay sign, that's bad, right? That's what I thought, yeah. Be careful with gestures. I know the very first time I went to Burundi, I would do this and children would flock to me. That means come here. Yeah. Okay. One of my favorite verses. As for you, brothers, don't grow weary in doing good. Actually, I got permission to take this picture. I want you to know. Very quickly, because we're behind. Cultural beliefs about service. I think you would agree in the United States, in the Western world, if you have means, you're looked very favorably upon about trying to help people out, right? I mean, we all admire Michael Dell or Bill Gates or, you know, Buffett or Bono. You know, just give tons of their treasure to help other people. Well, in other cultures, that can be a little tricky, okay? It's not saying not to do it, but you need to think about it. There's whole notions of pride and shame. You know, the concept of face, of self-pride in a lot of the developing world is very powerful. Family orientation. You know, there's not nursing homes there. Your family takes care of you. So that can be kind of a slap at that. And then just the whole historical context. You know, like I said before, here you are. Where were you guys in 93 when the genocide was going on? Nobody came to help then. Or just the failure of other mission groups. The world is littered with missionaries that come and leave. So trust can be an issue there too. Okay, resources. Very quickly. There may be more people than handouts, and if so, we can make copies for you if you want. Some of this is just to look at and throw away. The big the big page is the last one. Two blogs. First one, this is Allison Feaster. She's a pediatrician who's been in Burundi for a number of years, and she wrote this really cool one-page blog about, I couldn't wait to get back to the States for my furlough, and then she was here and go, where do I really belong? It's kind of about biculturalism. This is a good friend of mine. Ruth Ackers is an amazing woman. She's a PhD pharmacist from England, and she helped set up our pharmacy and part of the clinic. And she fell in love with and married our lawyer, our HR director there. And she wrote a little blog called Claude's Culture Shock. It's about not only going to England to visit her family, but about just traveling through other parts of Africa where the languages were different and they thought he was a local, and some of his frustrations. Two books. The one on the right, let's see. Yes, you're right. I'm sorry. When Helping Hurts. I think everybody should read this before they go. It makes you decide, do you need to go? Now, I don't agree with everything in this book, but it's very powerful about, are we always doing the right thing by going? And if we go, how should we allocate our assets and resources when we're there? Best $100 you can spend if you're interested. This is a secular group called Unite for Sight. They're kind of an offshoot from the Yale Global Health Initiative. And for $100, you can get a master's certificate, which is essentially 15 hours toward a master's in global health, refugee health, NGO management, social sustainability. Just go to their website and check it out. And then the most important page is the last one. It has a lot of resources on there. I think those are all reliable. But the biggest resource, look at where you are. Go to every booth. If you listen to the speakers, enjoy the plenary sessions, but go to all these booths. There's tons of resources here that'll help you. Last slide is a pep talk. Last year, the theme was just say yes, and this year's take the first step. This is an amazing guy that I got to hear speak in our little hometown of Brownwood. This is Dennis Cochran. This picture was taken, I think, in 64 or 65. Dennis went to Papua New Guinea with his wife and two children. His wife's a nurse. The youngest child was 5 weeks old, 1964, okay? They embed themselves in the Duna people. He stayed 12 years. The Duna people did not have a written language. It was all spoken, okay? He developed a written language for them, and within a decade, translated the entire New Testament to them. This entire tribe is now Christian. His wife saved countless lives and also rearranged the way they look at preventive, you know, kind of basic hygiene and things. He just said yes. He took the first step. One of my favorite verses also from Proverbs, a man's heart plans his course, but the Lord commands his steps. You wouldn't be here if you weren't intrigued. You know, I want to go. I want to go back. Pray about it. Think about it. And just say yes. One thing, I know I've got 2 seconds. There's probably no time for questions, but this is kind of funny. In the Duna, in English, our soul is our heart, right? I give my heart to you, you know, whatever. In the Duna language, it's the stomach. So they would give their stomach to Jesus. So I guess a man's stomach plans his course, but anyway. Listen, thank you all very much. I probably have time for like 2 questions, if anybody's got it. But otherwise, we can meet afterward. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Okay. What do you think the definition of a short mission trip is? Yeah. Yeah. 2 weeks to 6 months. You know, I've seen even some definitions less than a year is a short-term mission. Okay. I think one of the speakers last night said, I'm very conflicted with short-term missions, even though that's all I do, but I go to support a long-term project. I mean, I think we have to be careful of, that's where that book helps. Why am I going and what can I accomplish? It's a pretty great staff. The doctor's fantastic. We have 2 advanced nurses who see patients also. The bulk of what we see are tropical diseases. Diarrhea, tons of malaria, depending on the season. Burundi doesn't have sort of the typical winter. It's a rainy season and a dry season, and in those rainy seasons, there's just tons of malaria. But then we also, what we're really trying to do, and a lot of malnutrition, and we're working on a malnutrition program. One of the things, though, that I'm really trying to bring is that there's a lot of chronic diseases that are not treated simply because historically people haven't lived long enough to die of diabetes and heart disease. But we're seeing a whole bunch of hypertension in late 20-year-olds and kind of trying to start with treatment and prevention for that. Anything else? All right, thank you guys very much. God bless you. You're in my prayers.